Come to order. The time is 10:09 on Thursday, March 14th. Members present are Representative Vance, Representative Kopp, Representative Newman, Representative Edgemond, and myself, Chair Stutes. Please silence your cell phones, and we're asking that the audience not approach the committee table. If you need to pass a note, please get the attention of my committee aide, Matt Greening, and he'll be happy to help you. I'd like to thank Selma Holland, the Fisheries Committee Secretary, and Eric Heimbigner from the Juno LIO for teleconferencing support. I would like to welcome Representative Newman back to the committee. We'll miss Representative Pruitt, who had scheduling conflicts with other committees, but we're pleased to have Representative Newman back amongst us. On the agenda today, a presentation on salmon hatcheries, Alaska Hatchery Research Program, and being a wise consumer of science by the Department of Fish and Game. There's a lot of concern and focus on salmon hatcheries right now on the Board of Fisheries, including the straying of hatchery fish, what effects that might be having, as well as how to be a good consumer of the science that is out there on the issue. As such, I thought it would be useful to educate the committee on the issue with a series of presentations. This will be the first segment, followed by a presentation from the different regional aquaculture associations themselves, and finally an off-site trip to DIPAC, the local hatchery here in Juneau. So with that, let's get started. And we have Sam Raybung, Director of Commercial Fisheries Division, Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and Bill Templin, Chief Salmon Scientist, Commercial Fisheries Division, Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And due to our limited time today, I'm asking that any committee member write down their questions and save them. And with that, we will start with Director Sam and his presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sam Raybung. I'm the Director of Alaska Department of Fish and Game, Division of Commercial Fisheries. With me is Bill Templin, our Chief Fisheries Scientist for the Commercial Fisheries Division. Thank you for inviting us here. I'm going to start off by providing some background about the program, including why we have one, some of our program guidance, and then show you what our production looks like statewide. All of this information is included in our annual report, which I believe has been distributed to you. So I will start off with, why do we have a fishery enhancement program in Alaska? In 1960, Alaska assumed control of fisheries management and instituted a new system of escapement-based in-season management. Only 21 million salmon were harvested in 1967, which is down from a peak of about 126.5 million in 1936. The four lowest consecutive harvests of the century were 1972 through 1975. So in 1971, the state of Alaska initiated its current salmon fishery enhancement program in response to these severely depressed commercial salmon fisheries. This is a graph showing the commercial harvest. This isn't the run size. This is the harvest of all species statewide from 1900 to 1974. So Alaska took two approaches to address the weak fisheries. Commercial fisheries management changes were made to provide for adequate escapement of spawners, and the newly formed Fisheries Rehabilitation Enhancement and Development, or FRED, division focused on developing the knowledge infrastructure and support systems necessary for rehabilitation and enhancement of the salmon fisheries of Alaska through hatchery production and other means. This integrated approach to recovering salmon included using escapement-based in-season management to ensure enough spawners would make it back, creating the limited entry program for the commercial fishery, which was the first in the nation, which stabilized the number of fishermen and the amount of gear or fishing power, and beginning the program of fisheries rehabilitation and enhancement in order to recover the depleted runs. The state constitution, Article 8, Section 15, was amended in 1972 to allow for limited entry and also for the efficient development of aquaculture in the state. Also, about 1976, the federal 200-mile EEZ through the Magnuson-Stevens Act went into effect, so that no doubt contributed to improving our fisheries. In 1974, the private sector was allowed to join the effort. Through lobbying efforts of fishery stakeholders, the legislators passed the private nonprofit Salmon Hatchery Act. Sorry. And its intent was, I'm jumping ahead, I apologize. The farsighted, forward-looking legislature not only wanted the state to engage in this program of fishery rehabilitation, they also wanted to set in place the mechanism for private nonprofit aquaculture corporations to own and operate salmon hatcheries and contribute to the common property fishery. And some have said the state began to adopt a user pay philosophy at this time. So the purpose of the private nonprofit, or PNP, Salmon Fishery Enhancement Program, is the recovery and support of Alaska's salmon fisheries and to provide an economic engine to support and grow coastal communities. It surprises some people to realize that the program isn't about fish, it's about fisheries. As I stated, there's guidance in the state constitution. I'm going to go through the next sections pretty quickly, and I just provide them here as a resource for you. There's guidance in state statutes. The primary one that directed the FRED division, or Fisheries Rehabilitation Enhancement and Development, is Article 16, or it's 1605.092. And then these are the specific salmon hatchery statutes. Then we also have guidance and regulation, the primary one being what we call Chapter 40, 5AC 40, which is the private nonprofit salmon hatcheries chapter in the commercial fisheries regulations. And beyond that, we also have policies that guide the program. The genetics policy, which was promulgated in 1985, is one of our primary guidances. All the other policies that were developed to guide the program have been adopted into regulation. So the program by design is stakeholder driven. The users of the resource determine what fishery enhancement is desirable in their area, and the ADF&G determines what's appropriate within our mandate to sustain natural production. The mechanism for this cooperative effort is the Regional Aquaculture Association, or RAA, working with the department within the regional planning team, RPT, process to develop a regional salmon plan. This shows the different salmon fishery enhancement planning regions statewide. Not all of them have active salmon fishery enhancement programs. In fact, only Southern Southeast, Northern Southeast, Prince William Sound, Cook Inlet, and Kodiak have active programs. So the regional planning team's primary responsibility is what we call regional comprehensive salmon planning. The RPT is advisory to the ADF&G commissioner on any salmon fishery enhancement planning and permitting within their region. I like to use the analogy of the advisory committees are advisory to the Board of Fish, the RPTs are advisory to the commissioner. This is a simple cartoon showing kind of the flow of information. The RPT is comprised of members of three voting members from the Regional Aquaculture Association, three voting members from the Department of Fish and Game. The public is encouraged and invited to participate. There's often ex officio non-voting seats that represent other user groups. All those things come together to provide advice to the commissioner, recommendations to the commissioner. And as I stated earlier, the primary duty of an RPT is developing the regional planning, regional comprehensive salmon plan. And that is supposed to document historic harvests and production, and also document the desired harvest goals by species, area, and time, and then also further identify any project opportunities to fulfill these plan goals and objectives. To be clear, not every region chooses to have an salmon fishery enhancement programs, and that is by design. It's not a one-size-fits-all approach. Every region gets to make its own decisions on what's desirable within their area. Now I'll talk a little bit about production numbers. This graph shows production in the North Pacific of all nations, so Canada, Japan, Korea, Russia, the United States, and all species from 1952 to 2017. You can see the release numbers have been fairly stable since about 1988 at about 5 billion juvenile salmon released annually. Chum salmon is by far the predominant species, and that's followed by pink salmon.
I'm going to break my own rule and ask you what cherry is.
Cherry is another species of salmon that occurs in Asia. It's very similar to a chum salmon.
Thank you.
And this is the location of our active hatcheries in Alaska. They're primarily located in southeast Alaska and in the Prince William Sound area. There are two hatcheries in Kodiak area and a few in the Cook Inlet area as well. So this is a graph of Alaska's production from 1973 to 2018. And this is all species stacked and represents all regions combined. In the interest of brevity, I did not include the breakout by regions, but I have that if you need it. Prince William Sound releases the most in terms of numbers, which are primarily pink salmon. That's followed by Southeast Alaska, which releases primarily chum salmon. Since 1995, the annual smolt releases have ranged from about 1.4 to 1.8 billion, with the highest number released in 2018 at just over 1.8 billion juveniles. So if you recall that earlier graph of harvest, that was all wild stock harvest. There wasn't any hatchery production to speak of back then. And so this graph shows wild stock harvest from 1900 to 2018. And this adds the hatchery component on top of it. I like to show this because it demonstrates that you can see the increase in wild salmon harvest levels occurred alongside the robust fishery enhancement program that we've been operating since the mid-70s. And that program, of course, is designed to supplement the harvest without having a negative effect on wild productivity. And that's about as fast as I can do it.
Nicely done.
I have one more slide. And I could read off the summary statement with this, but in interest of time, I think I'll just stop with that unless you want more.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Commissioner Raybon? Thank you, Commissioner. Appreciate it. And next?
Thank you, Representative Suits.
Uh-huh. We will move. Bill Templin, please. And I, before you start, I just really want to tell you both how much I appreciate condensing these presentations into this time frame that we have, this brief window. We're very grateful to you. Thank you. And with that, I'll allow you to begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bill Templin. I'm the Chief Fishery Scientist for Salmon for the Division of Commercial Fisheries for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I've been invited here to present about 7 hours of material that occurred over 2 days last week, but I promise you I won't take 7 hours. I've put it down into as close to 30 minutes as I can. It will be a little bit like taking a sip from a fire hose. I've done my best to narrow it down to just the main points. And I've also put it together so that there's a flow here from why is it that there might be some concern around hatcheries. What is the department doing about that concern in terms of research? And then how does the department and others, how do we plan on interpreting the information that we receive as from the research? So, and I'll finish with a little lecture on how to be a wise consumer of science. As I mentioned, much of the what you'll see today is a compilation of presentations done by colleagues. There are a large number of people who were responsible for this work. So while I'll take responsibility here for it, it's not all my work. Beginning, taking a step all the way back to the Constitution, there was a constitutional provision that required the resources of the state to be utilized, developed, and maintained on the sustained yield principle, subject to preferences among beneficial uses. That sustained yield principle was intended to provide for continued production from the resources. In other words, we need to take a long-term view and provide for our children, grandchildren, and the generations to come. From that, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game has a mission statement which requires the department to both protect, maintain, improve, and manage the use and development of the fish, game, and aquatic resources of the state. Now, if you take a look at these four verbs, they all fall on separate sides of the idea of using or maintaining, preserving or improving, protecting. It's a balancing act that the department needs to take in order to manage the fish, game, and aquatic plant resources of the state. And this mission statement ends with the injunction that they're to be managed in the best interest of the economy and the well-being of the people of the state. Again, recognizing it needs to be consistent with the sustained yield principle. This is not a new idea, but it's interesting that it was recognized early on that the use of the resources is for people. Even when we talk about things like maximum sustained yield, which is commonly used when discussing fisheries management, we need to realize that it must be recognized that the welfare of people and not fish is the reason for a management program, and that if maximum sustained yield has any validity, it is as a means to important human ends rather than just as an end in itself. Some working definitions for common terms. One is sustainable development. What is sustainability? Using a UN definition that most people refer to, sustainable development is development that meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. In this very statement, we can substitute the term development with the term fishery, and that's pretty much a definition of sustainable fisheries. In policy, even, we have statements about how should we do sustainable management. Paragraph 5 of the Policy for Management of Sustainable Salmon Fisheries, we see that there's a recognition that we face uncertainty. There's uncertainty in salmon stocks, fisheries, artificial propagation, habitat, etc. And in the face of that uncertainty, we need to manage conservatively. So what does that mean? Well, a term that gets used a lot is precautionary, thinking ahead, understanding potentially the potential risks. Even if we don't have all the information, what could happen, and how do we go about managing in a precautionary manner? So if we take a look at that precautionary principle, the principle itself, the rule or standard that gets applied, is that when human activities may lead to morally unacceptable harm that is scientifically plausible but uncertain, actions should be taken to avoid or diminish that harm. Much like you might start slowing down early as you were entering an intersection on an icy road. You understand that there are risks out there. You don't know if any other cars are coming, but you take precautionary action. The precautionary approach, then, is the method that should be applied, is a set of agreed to cost-effective measures and actions, including future courses of action, which ensure prudent foresight, reduce or avoid risk to the resource, the environment, and people, and to the extent possible, take explicitly into account existing uncertainties and the potential consequence of being wrong. It's a lot of words. There's a lot packed in there. But this is the method that's recognized as precautionary and should be applied. So if we look at this paragraph, it says a precautionary approach should be applied to the regulation and control of harvest and other human-induced sources of salmon mortality. If we look at the middle section of that very same paragraph, we see that prudent foresight accounts for uncertainty in fisheries. It accounts for uncertainty in habitat. The risk, what kind of risks should be considered? Biological, social, cultural, and economic risks need to be considered. And it also recognizes that often we need to act in the face of incomplete knowledge. This is where we are now currently with enhancement-related activities. We need to act in a precautionary manner. We don't have all the information, but we're working to gain it. We need to think about the risks, biological as well as social, cultural, and economic risks that are faced. So that's a long preamble to get us into why are we doing this? Why is it an issue that, potentially hatchery fish stray? Why is it such a conversation similar to, say, what's the correct load for being in bear country? You know, it always sparks a variety of opinions. We face it, though, because Alaska has taken on hatchery and salmon enhancement as a means to economic benefit. But we face that production. In the face of that production, we also have the requirement to sustain natural production, the natural production of salmon. So let's talk about straying. In Pacific salmon, straying and homing are part of their natural life cycle. If salmon home, and some species home more than others, homing allows them to develop local adaptations. They become fit in their environment. It leads to greater differences between populations, which acts a bit like your stock portfolio. And it leads to improved survival of the offspring when they come back because they fit the environment better. They can be more productive. So we manage risk in salmon, can manage risk by homing and becoming better fit to their environment over time. But there's also benefits from straying. Salmon recognize benefits from straying because that allows them to access new habitats, such as Glacier Bay, when the glaciers recede, streams become open, salmon access those streams and form new productive populations in situations like that. It also leads to increased diversity within populations by separate groups having some interaction between each other. You maintain a large amount of genetic diversity within the population. You don't lose some of it through chance and genetic drift. Finally, it's also a way to buffer temporal variation in habitat quality. If all populations are somewhat interacting with each other and all of a sudden one stream gets wiped out by a flood event, you have other populations that contain that genetic information and can help maintain productivity. So homing and straying act kind of in balance in different different salmon populations and species. As an example, sockeye salmon. Sockeye salmon are an example of a species that has strong homing. So they have a long freshwater residency. So they want to be in a lake system that's good to grow in or for their offspring to grow in. That leads to higher variability in habitat because in a lake-type system, you can spawn along the shore, you can spawn in a stream that comes into the lake or a stream that goes out of the lake. Lake systems tend to have higher stability in their habitat. They tend to have lower changes in flow and temperature regimes, et cetera. So that leads to variable year life cycles. Sockeye salmon will return 2, 3, 4, 5-year-old sockeye will return. As a counterexample are pink salmon. They have a short freshwater residency. As soon as they emerge from the gravel, pink salmon tend to go right out to the ocean, whereas sockeye can stay from 0 to 2 or 3 years in a lake system. They have lower variability in habitat. They tend to, if you look at the streams I've got present here, you can see that they're low gradient, rocky streams, generally near marine waters. However, these streams have lower stability in their habitat. If you go to Prince William Sound in the spring, you'll see many of the streams have a large gravel berm in front of them from freshet events or flood events. So it changes. It's not stable. So what pink salmon do is they tend to have a one-year life cycle, basically 2 years. They just, from the time that they emerge, they'll return a year later. This leads, in some ways, it can lead to lower selection for homing. So pink salmon will stray more as a species than sockeye salmon. There's a biology 101 lesson for you in a nutshell. I'll take questions on it if you'd like. So let's talk about what stray rates are. People use the term stray rate, but it can mean many, many things. So first we can talk about the stray in rate, or the recipient stray rate. This is the proportion of fish that you find in a spawning location that didn't come from that location, right? They weren't born in that stream or in that lake. They strayed in, okay? So they're coming into the system. The stray out rate, or the donor stray rate, that's the proportion of fish from a given location that didn't return to that location. They went somewhere else. So it's all depends on your perspective, whether you're thinking about straying in or straying out. Generally, we're going to be talking for the rest of this talk on the stray in rate, because that's what many people are concerned about, hatchery fish in wild fish spawning streams. So Alaska's precautionary approach to hatcheries. This has been laid out. Each of these sections could easily be a 30-minute talk. So I won't go over this report, but Special Publication 18-12 is a review of Alaska's precautionary approach. What have we done, along with what Director Raybung mentioned earlier today? There are structures that exist, policies, plans, permits, that recognize the risks that exist out there and try to do them in a reasonable manner, controlling that risk so that Alaskans can also receive the benefit. As part of these policies, there are directions for management, for maintaining fish health, and for maintaining genetics. Within this report, then, we provide two case studies, one in Southeast Alaska king salmon and the other in Prince William Sound pink salmon. Out of that whole report, I'd like to just briefly talk about the policy elements that are dealt with in the management policy, the fish health policy, and genetics. In management, it's established that wild stock conservation has the chief priority. We need to sustain populations, wild populations, and production then get priority. We also need to manage for sustained yield, not taking short-term gains, but making sure that we have enough for future production. And there's a recognition that stocks do interact. Hatchery fish and wild fish do interact. Or even wild fish stock do interact in our fisheries, and so we need to manage accordingly. For fish health, there's a recognition that there can be health concerns with bringing fish into a hatchery. So we have a robust pathology lab and a pathology program, and there are inspections that go on to make sure that hatchery fish, when released, don't add a disease load to the wild populations. And then has been mentioned, is the genetics policy, which describes things like using appropriate local stocks. We use a local stock so that if there is an interaction, if their hatchery fish do stray out of the hatchery into the local rivers, they're actually from that. They originated from that river, so they're more likely to be genetically benign. We also identify significant unique wild stocks and wild stock sanctuaries. That more or less has been applied. There's assessment of hatchery and wild stock interaction and impacts. And that's the part that I'm going to move towards, okay?
Before you move there, I just want to acknowledge that we have online Chris Burns, who is our mayor from Old Harbor in Kodiak. He's listening to your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. So we're on to slide 17, if you're listening in. This is in recognition, as I said previously, there needs to be assessment of hatchery and wild stock interaction and impact. So there have been some studies in the past decade or so that demonstrate that or document that there are hatchery fish in wild systems. We can do that because hatchery fish are marked, their otolith, their ear bone, is marked in the hatchery with a banding pattern. If you go to the streams and you collect carcasses and you take the ear bones out, we can read those and see whether a fish originated from a hatchery or from a wild situation. Based on those observations, then, we have two ongoing studies. One is a smaller one in Lower Cook Inlet with pink salmon. It's looking at the contributions of hatchery pink salmons to harvest, as well as the escapement. Then we have a much larger long-term one called the Alaska Hatchery Research Program, which is actually looking at two regions, both Prince William Sound and Southeast Alaska, and looking at two species,
pink and chum salmon. In addition, there are three big questions that it's trying to address. So it's shrunk all the potential research that could go on down to three questions that have a reasonable chance of being answered and are informative. And we'll talk about that. But first, I would like to overview the Lower Cook Inlet Pink Salmon Project. This is being carried out by two biologists in Homer, Ted Otis and Glenn Hollowell. They realized that there was a great opportunity. The Tutka Bay hatchery, as well as the Port Graham hatchery, had produced pink salmon a decade ago. Then the programs were shut down for a little while, and then they were being restarted. And they realized we have an opportunity to get in at the beginning and get some observations. So this study was designed by these two gentlemen. I'm presenting their work here. Again, the purpose was to gather baseline data on the hatchery wild composition of harvest and escapement in Lower Cook Inlet as these two recently reopened hatcheries began releasing marked fry. Their objectives were to estimate hatchery wild composition of the commercial harvest to see if there was a benefit to fishermen, and the second was to monitor escapement to hatchery fish to pink salmon streams. They also wanted to just make sure that they, in the presence of hatchery fish and harvest directed on hatchery fish, that they could still just meet escapement goals within these streams.
I'd like to take a moment to recognize Representative Hannon, who's joined us. Thank you.
Now, this slide is really busy. It's here mainly for you to be able to refer to in the future. But I would like to point out that the cost recovery harvest, both in Tutka Lagoon and Port Graham, is largely composed of pink salmon generated from those hatcheries. And in the common property harvest, good portions of pink salmon from these hatcheries are contributing to the common property harvest. There's a lot that could be said here, but for the sake of time, I'm not going to brush it over because it's not important, but we did a lot of detail there. So let's just skip to the escapement portion here. This has generated a lot of interest in the public, and that's because not only are they finding local hatchery strays in these streams in Lower Cook Inlet, they've also been finding some Prince William Sound pink salmon in these streams. That was not expected at the time. What's provided here on this plot is a number of, I think it's 10 streams, 10 locations. Those locations, they've collected opportunistically some samples. These are the samples that have been collected in four or five years, so we have multiple years of observation. In each little bubble, the top number is the proportion, average proportion in those samples of Prince William Sound fish. The lower number is the Lower Cook Inlet origin hatchery fish. So you can see that in many situations, the numbers are down, you know, in the below 10% range. But in a couple of them, while there might be, say, Barbara Creek, which is in the middle there, there might be 3.5% of Lower Cook Inlet. 3.5% of the, on average, of the samples collected were from Lower Cook Inlet hatcheries. On average, 27% were from Prince William Sound. In the samples. So, what we have here is we have some biologists doing work trying to collect information, but what we don't have is a long-term, well-designed study that needs to happen to start addressing the observations that are seen here. So in conclusion, our conclusions have to be relatively weakened because the samples are not from a designed study. They're opportunistic. That doesn't mean that this isn't important, though, and that these aren't important observations. These are the conclusions provided by the authors. I'd like to point out, first of all, one of the middle ones there, that pink salmon index streams still meet their escapement goals just about as often as they normally would. About 80% of them over the 5 years have been met, and that's about what the department average is. So So they are meeting escapement even in the presence of fishing on hatchery fish. Also, Lower Cook Inlet hatchery produced pink salmon present in our stream samples can range from 0% to 87%. Now that 87% seems really large, but that 87% is like a one-time occurrence in one location. So going to the final conclusion there, interpretation of current data is limited given the fact that we have few years sampled and that there's not a designed program here. It's important for the department to be able to use information from this project. It's important for us to push ahead and develop a program to actually answer questions. How much of the actual escapement in Lower Cook Inlet or in these streams is from hatchery fish? We can't take these numbers and generate that. We can only say on a given visit of carcasses I sampled, X amount were from a hatchery. Now, in contrast, after observations such as those in Prince William Sound in Southeast Alaska, the department, in collaboration with private nonprofit hatchery operators, processors, and others, developed the Alaska Hatchery Research Program in order to try to come up with some information that would help us to interpret these types of observations of stray fish in the wild streams. Much of this background you've already heard, but the important portion down is it towards the bottom that, I'm going to skip this one for time. Let's go to this one here. So these large-scale salmon releases have raised concerns for wild stock impacts. We've observed hatchery fish in wild escapements. It's a concern. What are we going to do about it? Questions that are asked are, do hatchery fish detrimentally affect productivity and sustainability of wild stocks? That's a question, that's a water cooler question that can take up a lot of time. But generally, it's data limited. We have these studies, like I said, that have demonstrated that they're hatchery fish, and sometimes larger than expected, or from a location that's not expected in these escapements. So next question then is it detrimental? Does it affect productivity and sustainability? Alaska's policy mandates that we have sustainable productivity from wild stocks. So it's a question that needs to be answered. It's not a new concern. Even when the hatchery program was being developed, Alaska at about the same time was developing the very first genetics policy among any of the states in the Union. That was finally finalized in 1985, and it's been used. So in recognition of the need to examine the extent and impact of hatchery strays on wild stock fitness and productivity, the PNP operators proposed that ADF&G organize a science panel of experts to design and implement a long-term research project to inform future resource management decisions. The funding for this project would come from a partnership of the state, operators, and industry. And the science panel would develop fundamental questions aimed at examining the extent and potential impacts of hatchery straying on fitness of wild stocks. It was focused on pink and chum salmon in Prince William Sound and chum salmon in Southeast Alaska. The charge to the science panel was to identify priority research questions and then develop the framework for research that would then be used to address these questions. The panel was made up of 13 members. Members came from the department, also National Marine Fisheries Service, federal colleagues, the University of Alaska, as well as the aquaculture associations. So the three questions that were generated, the first one, what is the genetic stock structure of pink and chum salmon in Prince William Sound in Southeast Alaska? This is important to understand because it provides the background on which these hatchery fish are straying into. What is the background of genetic structure that that we'd be able to throw our results up against and understand the results in context? What is the extent and annual variability of straying? So the intent here was to go and design a program to get answers in a structured way that would then help us understand how much straying is happening from pink salmon hatcheries into the streams of Prince William Sound. And third, what is the impact of these hatchery fish on the fitness of natural pink and chum salmon? And fitness here is defined as productivity, because that's really what we're looking for here, is the productivity of the natural system. I'm going to skip question one because the background, I would have to spend probably 5 minutes helping you understand how the population structure works. I'm going to cut right to the exciting stuff. This is question number two. What's the extent of straying and the amount of straying? So what you have here are the Prince William Sound results for pink salmon and chum salmon. Pink salmon are on the left, chum salmon are on the right. You see a map of Prince William Sound. And the bar charts, each box has three bars. First bar is 2013, next is 2014, the third one is 2015. The blue portion is the relative proportion that are from the natural production, and the red portion is that proportion of the escapement that came from hatcheries strays. So you can see that there's, and by the way, these also are district estimates, not stream estimates. So these are district-wide estimates. And as you can see, there's some patterns in straying and pink salmon. You'll see the more red as you move down to the southwest corner of the sound, and less red, more blue as you move to the east side. A similar pattern is also seen in chum, where you'll see the most red is down along Montague, and there's a large release of chum salmon in that area. That area was actually chosen because the streams in that area have not been productive for chum salmon since changes in the earthquake. But you can see that for both those species, the stray proportion of the escapement can range from almost zero to as high as about 85 or 90%. If we look at it overall, over the entire sound, pink salmon in 2013, that's at the bottom, 2013, 4.5% of the total escapement of pink salmon in Prince William Sound was from hatchery origin. And that ranged from that 4.5% to as high as almost 15% in 2014. And then chum has each of those three years kind of hung around about 3% of the total escapement of chum salmon in Prince William Sound was estimated to be from hatchery origin. We look at Southeast Alaska chum, much the same here. You can see there were three regions that were estimated. Again, 2013, 14, and 15. You'll see that the district-wide hatchery proportion in the escapement for a district ranged from 1.5% to as high as 12, almost 13%. But overall in Southeast Alaska, the total proportion of hatchery fish adding to the escapement of wild fish was ranged from 5.5% to 9%. So now we know kind of the distribution, the extent, and the amount of straying, at least for these 3 years in these two regions. The interesting thing about this is using this information, we can actually, we can actually now, for the first time, estimate the actual natural run and the actual hatchery run. Before, it was very difficult or impossible to estimate how many hatchery fish were in wild escapement. And so the escapement was always considered to be natural, even though we knew it wasn't. Now we have the total amount. And you can see that from that we can estimate the harvest rate. And you can see that the hatchery harvest rates in the bottom box there. In 2013, we harvested or accounted for 99% of the hatchery fish, which is pretty impressive. And managers were able to do that while only having a 53% harvest rate on the natural stocks within Prince William Sound, which was one of the very interesting results from this study, that our current management systems allow us to direct our harvest on hatchery stocks, which are intended to be for harvest, and at the same time maintain reasonable harvest rates on the natural stocks. Question three, that's the one about fitness. Are we hurting the productivity of the natural system? This, again, I could go in probably for an hour and a half on this, but I will cut just to the simple part. We're going to look at paternity. We're going to take offspring and trace them back to their parents, but we're going to not do this in a laboratory or a hatchery. We're going to do this in the wild, which is why this has never been done before. And when we started, people said it couldn't be done. But we've been able to demonstrate that, yes, it can. So we'll collect parents 1 year, and then 2 years later, we'll go back to the fish returning to that same stream, sample those. Those should be the offspring of the parents that we sampled earlier. We then can use genetics to do a paternity test and match offspring back to their parents. Now, from those parents, what we've done is pulled the otoliths, so now we can say this parent came from a hatchery or came from the natural. Mm-hmm. So using that and the offspring, we can go back and look to see what is the relative productivity of a hatchery fish in the wild, mm-hmm. What's the relative productivity of a natural fish in the wild. Are they the same? Are they different? How productive are hatchery fish in the wild? Now, we've sampled 5 streams, so we had to replicate this across streams. We're sampling for 7 years. Now, pink salmon are odd and even, so they're really 2 separate lines. So for the odd, we'll have 13, 15, 17, and 19. So we'll have 4 observations. And for the even year, we'll have 14, 16, and 18. So we'll be looking not just at children, but hopefully we'll be able to get it to grandchildren of the original parents, which will help us to understand how much is potentially environmental and how much is genetic. This is really a large project. There's 150,000 fish we expect to have to analyze. When you think that the average fish genetics lab does about 30,000 a year, but our department's lab does between 80 and 100,000 a year, we're talking about almost 2 years of their full production, not counting the work that they do for Cook Inlet, for Bristol Bay and other places. So we have results from 1 year, from one stream, one generation from one stream. So because we have results, first we've proven that doing pedigrees in nature is possible. We're going to talk about the even year lineage, where we were able to, out of 1,000 sampled, we were able to trace 451 offspring back to 184 parents. That's at a rate of about 11% of the samples that we analyzed were able to find a parent for. Now, the relative return per spawner, that's hatchery fish productivity compared to wild fish productivity, is about 47 for this 1 year in this one location. So 47% hatchery fish in our samples here is about half as effective as a wild fish in the wild. Okay, that's one data point, though. Remember, we have 5 streams to go through, and we're going to have multiple generations in each of those streams. So this demonstrates that it's possible, but I want to mention that it's not, it's doesn't settle the question yet, because we have a lot of data points to take a look at, and I'll show that in a few minutes here. For males, that was for females. For males, it's about 87%, and that's really not statistically different than equal, based on the samples that we had. In the odd lineage, we had 48 offspring traced back to 20 parents. It's a really small sample size. Only 2.5% of the individuals could be traced back to a parent. Underrepresentation of offspring assigned to hatchery origin parents is a problem in both of these studies at this point in time, but it's just early on. So what can we draw from this study? Hatchery origin fish did spawn and did produce adult offspring that we were able to sample. Hatchery origin fish also spawned with other with natural origin fish, because we were, some of these we were able to trace back to both parents. And then you'd know whether it was a hatchery fish, hatchery wild, or a wild. And those matings did produce adult natural origin fish. On average, hatchery origin fish produced fewer adult offspring that returned to Hogan Bay and were sampled than their natural origin conspecifics, natural origin fish. There are potentially important differences in relative return per spawner between male and female hatchery origin fish. So that's about where we know right now. This is just breaking news. There's a lot of work yet to be done. So once we have this information like this, I'm wrapping up here real soon. Once we have this information, how are we going to interpret it? If I were to say to you, you know, 42, what would you think? You'd probably be thinking 42 what? Or 42 how? What's it relative to? Same thing here. We're going to have these numbers, but we're not going to sure know how to interpret them, so it's time for us to begin thinking about that. First of all, let's start with what the research will not answer. There are certain questions that won't be answered by this program. First is, what are the competition and predation effects of hatchery fish? This won't answer that yet. Do hatchery fish reduce the genetic resilience of wild populations? We will be able to begin addressing that. This is the very beginning of that, but we won't be able to come up with a hard answer to that yet. If changes in productivity are observed, what mechanisms could be driving these differences? That's won't be answered by the number. It'll be answered by taking those numbers and looking at other research that's happening to try to understand what the numbers mean. And finally, how will findings affect policy? That's not really a science question then. Now we're moving into human valuations, decisions made based on culture and economics as well. So, Fish and Game is assessing the risk. The information we have now, we now have information on wild system productivity. We have information on hatchery proportions. We're collecting information on the genetic background. That's the population structure work. We're collecting information on the relative productivity. I've shown you the very first data point of in a large series of them. Once the study is completed and we have the results, it'll be time for interpretation of those results and understanding the implications for management.
For that sake of time, can we skip to 42, please?
We're skipping to 42. Here, I want to show you this right here.
I think it's important for the committee to...
So take a look at this. This is a study of Steelhead and Hood River, relative return per spawner. You see the orange circle is a female hatchery female. The blue triangle is a hatchery male. And you can see that line on there is 1.0. That means if those dots were there, they were equally productive as a wild steelhead. You can see here from this information that the hatchery fish are only about 80% effective. But that's only 1 year of observation. If we add another year, the next year, you'll see that in that year, hatchery fish were about as equally productive as a wild fish in the wild. And as we add more dots, you'll see that there's a lot of variation. That's why I'm encouraging everybody to understand that we have that one piece of information from Hogan Bay. In a couple of years, we'll have all of this information. We'll have a much broader picture of what the relative return per spawner means. Mechanisms, these effects can last one generation on one side, or they can last for many generations. So we have to start thinking about, you know, what are the potential sources of potential risk to wild populations. So looking at risk, if we look along the bottom side, probability of something happening is along the bottom from low to high, and the severity from low to high along the y-axis, you can see there are regions of low and high risk. And you know, if we find that it's 50%, reduction in productivity is about 50%, we're in that within that black box there, And you can see that's where we're starting to look. We're out of the high and the low risk range. We're in the medium risk range, no matter whether it's a low severity or higher severity. This is one way to start getting an idea and forming the conversation about the risk that hatchery fish might pose. Oops, sorry, wrong way. So it's important for us to be wise consumers of the science. Scientific method, as you can see here, is this is what you may have seen in high school or junior high. We start with making observations, then thinking of interesting questions, formulating hypotheses, etc. The principles behind the scientific method are that we make careful observations, we formulate and test hypotheses, and those hypotheses have to be able to be proven false. If you can't prove it false, it's not really a hypothesis. Okay. Then we, through a process, we refine that hypothesis, and we're skeptical even as we go through. We're trying to figure out if we're being fooled. Finally, from that, we develop grand theories, and then we go back to making observations. So there are many examples of scientific method in practice. One I have here is the critical period hypothesis. For the sake of time, let's just say that it's a theory that's not proven, but it's following the scientific process. They made observations in ocean surveys and looking at salmon returns, that something was happening in the marine environment. They started asking interesting questions. When does that happen? Does it happen when they first enter it or after they're coming back? Formulated hypotheses, and now they're in the cycle where they're testing the hypothesis, gathering data, refining the hypothesis, going around and around in this big red circle. And the debate there is elevating the science. That's part of the scientific method. You do this piece before you move to developing grand theories. So the ramifications, though, of incomplete scientific process, first, it's not always negative, but sometimes it places on the reader the burden to understand the limitations of what the research is telling you. And while this is part of elevating science, science really is stuck in the circle until some sort of resolution can be made and it can move forward. It's a good thing, but science is not really moving forward at that point in time. The example I showed last Friday was a paper that's recently come out describing pink salmon effects on orca in Puget Sound, which is a big issue because it's an endangered species. They started with observations that southern resident killer whale population was declining in Puget Sound. There was a two-year pattern for a portion of that. They thought, pink salmon have a two-year life cycle. I wonder. So made observations. They thought of interesting questions. Are pink salmon responsible for this pattern? They formed some hypotheses, or they present some hypotheses. First is that odd-year pink salmon interfere and hurt the orca, or the opposite one is that because there aren't very many even-year pink salmon, maybe that's helping orca somehow. Problem is, neither of those is falsifiable at this point in time, and in fact, the bottom one is really difficult to distinguish. It's hard to prove that there's no effect. The authors then recognize that, the need for additional analyses and rationale to explain this pattern. But we wish to facilitate rapid communication of these unique findings because a greater understanding of southern resident killer whale demography enhances the likelihood for advancing the recovery. That's not the sentence that most people read when they read this paper. Instead, it gets picked up by the news, and there's a whole cycle of news stories and articles saying that pink salmon had been found to be the new reason for the decline of killer whales. This is bad because we've jumped right from the scientific method, skipped all that bit about refining the hypotheses, collecting information, and gone straight to publication. All right. So, and this is something that all of us can do. We're doing a simple word search on this paper. This paper's about whales, right? So looking for the term whale or southern resident killer whale, you can see incidences across the paper. Those are sections there, the abstract, the introduction, methods, results. These are standard portions of a scientific paper. And you can see a distribution of those words across that. So you can see they're being discussed everywhere. However, if we look for pink salmon, Chinook salmon, or salmon itself, you'll see an absence of those terms in the introduction, is where you introduce the whole idea, or the methods, when you talk about how you're going to do the analysis, or even the results, the analysis you have. Salmon is missing there, but salmon is all in the discussion. So this paper presents hypotheses, but it does nothing to advance that. And of course, as you can see, it got picked up by the news. So concluding thoughts, responsibility for scientists is to communicate research clearly and effectively. For the reader, it's to evaluate the strength of the paper or of the newspaper article that you're reading. And an example is chocolate good or bad for you? You know, that's a debate that goes on as well. So the peer review process is not perfect. Review of manuscripts is voluntary on scientists. Reviewers evaluate for science, but not for the splash factor. Publication does not imply full acceptance by the science community. And there are incentives on authors as well as journals to publish things that make a good news story because it helps generate reputations. So, with that said, other questions?
I thank you very kindly for the rapid.
Sorry, I tried to make
you did a fabulous job. I know you condensed a huge amount of information. I appreciate the indulgence of the committee members. I want to thank you. It's important information that will serve as the foundation of coming meetings. Hatcheries have a tremendous effect economically on Alaska, on our fishermen, the food supply. I think the information in this presentation is timely given the discussion at the Board of Fish. We know straying is occurring. What we don't know is what the effects are. Is straying also occurring within natural populations? Does straying of hatchery fish even have any negative effects on wild populations? In certain samples from other studies, reproductive productivity is actually higher in hatchery fish. Why is that? The bottom line is we don't know. We need more data because there's a lot of open questions and not enough answers. We need to conduct more studies and then be a wise consumer of that science before we jump to conclusions. This debate needs to be governed by good science. I am pleased that the Department and the Board of Fisheries have that same stance and are taking a hard look at this through that lens. With that, the next Fishery Committee hearing is Tuesday, March 19th at 9:45. The committee will hear a presentation on hatcheries by the Regional Aquaculture Association themselves on their activities. So, with no further business, and another big thank you to our guests today, I will adjourn the meeting at 12:10.